You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you all for joining us, and thank you to Maria Teresa for moderating and introducing Janie. And Janie, as you know, is our Open Society Fellow working on the intersections of labor law and human trafficking. And with that, I'll throw it open to Maria Teresa and to Janie. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Vipasha, and welcome everyone. Thanks so much for joining us for this lunch conversation, and thank you, Janie, for joining us as well. And as you all know, I'm Maria Teresa Rojas, and I direct the International Migration Initiative here in, at OSF. I'm based in New York, but we do focus mainly on issues related to labor migration in Asia to the Middle East and within Central America and Mexico. And we also do some global migration governance type of issues and improving policymaking on migration. But I should start by saying that, you know, IMI does not have a separate or explicit focus on trafficking. It is without a doubt that our approach to the protection of migrants touches very much directly on issues related to trafficking, issues such as the use of deception and coercion in recruitment practices of migrants and in the other practices related to forced labor. It is really in practice and in also policy, I believe we will hear, you know, not necessarily a good thing for us to see these as separate issues. They're completely interrelated, so we deal with trafficking issues in an indirect way. Wherever the trafficking framework or trafficking legislation is used as a compelling action to protect migrants and to prevent forced labor and other labor rights violations by our grantees, we are fully in support of that. Again, we see that as central to our mission anyway. But we are, as in any case, as the more I do this work, I realize that there is a great need for dialogue on this topic and discourse. Among the grantees, among the different fields, and what a great opportunity for us to talk about it here amongst ourselves first today. Janie's work is actually very invaluable. It's the pivotal, it's the thing that has actually allowed us to say, let's see what your work reveals, and that would inform and provoke more, hopefully lead to some type of programming and provoke more action at the OSF level on this issue. The nexus, interested, of course, again, the nexus between trafficking and migration. As you know, Janie is an associate law professor at the American University, has spent part of her research that concludes this October. We'll be looking at reframing trafficking as a labor migration issue and how it can lead to perhaps, you know, better policy making and better protections for migrants in both countries of origin and countries of destination. That's it for me, and we'll hear from Janie, and then we hope that you have questions and comments, and we'll open it up and have an actual dialogue. We'll be here until 1:30, so I think we have a good amount of time.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and to all of you for coming today. I'm so thrilled to hear that this project is provoking some thought about the intersection with trafficking. Because the reason why I wanted to undertake this project was because, first of all, let me just say a little bit about my background as a trafficking advocate and scholar. I've been working on human trafficking issues since 1997 and was involved in the drafting of the International Treaty on Trafficking, and have been sort of there from the beginning watching the development of this field. And what's always struck me is the separation from of trafficking as an issue from labor. So during the protocol, that we call the trafficking treaty, the Palermo Protocol, during those negotiations, the International Labor Organization was not there, not visible at all. And it just struck me as strange because it's always been in my mind, you know, when we talk about trafficking, and what I mean by trafficking is when you have the recruitment or movement of a person using some form of force, fraud, or coercion to put them in a situation of servitude, essentially. That, to me, has always seemed to be very closely tied to labor, right? Exploitative labor. When we're talking about debt bondage, we're talking about, you know, involuntary servitude. How could this not be a labor issue? But the labor advocacy community was resolutely not part of the trafficking, the development of this trafficking paradigm. And I think there are a lot of complicated reasons for why.
And where was the migration field
in the migration field, I'm not really
even
sure. Actually, I didn't even see that. ILO sort of submitted something having to deal with children. But the migration.
So it's really three fields
converge. But what's been exciting over the last couple of years is, I think, finally a realization that these two fields shouldn't be, you know, viewed as mutually exclusive, right? And that it's porous. The issues are porous, and they're so related, and they have to be considered together if we're going to come up with effective solutions. So one concrete way of thinking about it is, you know, in the trafficking field, the interventions we've had in trafficking have focused on this paradigm known as the three P's, which are prosecution of the traffickers, protection of the victims, and prevention of trafficking. A lot of the focus has been on prosecution. I mean, people think about trafficking as a criminal justice framework, which it is, because the trafficking treaty, at least internationally, is attached to an international convention on transnational organized crime. So from the development of trafficking, from the very beginning, it was framed as a criminal justice issue. Mm-hmm. And it's been really hard to break out of that framework and to say, look, this is a human rights issue, this is a labor issue, because the boundaries were set so early on. But in recent years, and another piece, big piece of this puzzle is the assumption that trafficking is only about sex. And having only to do with the sex sector, arguably there's a lot more trafficking outside of the sex sector than within the sex sector. Again, statistics are hotly contested, but there seems to be a growing consensus that non-sex sector trafficking is actually much higher, despite the incredible amount of focus on sex. But in recent years, there's been a recognition, I think, you know, in large part due to amazing advocacy work by people in migration, in labor, and within trafficking who have been saying from the beginning, we need to not just look at sex. So there's now a broader recognition that trafficking does include sectors outside of the sex industry. And there's also been an interesting movement to think about what exactly trafficking is in a much more expansive way than the drafters of the treaty initially viewed it. And so now there's a lot of angst, actually, in terms of the role of various institutions, particularly in the labor field, because initially, you know, I mentioned to you the definition of trafficking requiring those three parts, right? That there's some kind of process of recruitment and movement using force, fraud, or coercion for the purposes of putting somebody into some sort of servitude situation. Now there's been an expansion of that definition such that, you know, the U.S. government is behind this expansion, I should say. The State Department is saying that, look, you know, trafficking is all servitude. It doesn't matter, like, if you were born into intergenerational bonded labor, that's trafficking, even though there's no movement, no recruitment. The ILO would say you need movement in order, you've got to move somebody into a situation. It doesn't have to be cross-border, but it's got to have some kind of process, right? Mm. And so there's now this expansion of the definition such that people are thinking about trafficking as a tool to deal with really much broader range of labor exploitation than ever contemplated. And so, you know, from a legal perspective, you know, some would say that's problematic, right? Because legal, you know, definitions matter, legal terms matter. But from pragmatically, maybe this is an opportunity, right? An opportunity, because trafficking is had so much attention, I think in large part because of the sex part of it, right? There's so much money in trafficking. It's outrageous.
So you confirmed that.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy.
I've been hearing this for many
years. No, there's a lot of money in trafficking. My advocacy friends and I joke about the trafficking industrial complex because what we see is advocacy organizations seeing that there's so much money in trafficking are, you know, redrafting their mission statements to say that they're doing trafficking work, right? And you see this, you know, certainly in areas of prostitution, advocacy work, certain feminist organizations trying to target prostitution, saying that this is trafficking and tapping into those funds. Mm-hmm. A lot of those funds were earmarked for that particular sector of advocacy. So I mean, the expansion of this notion of what trafficking covers, I think, can be helpful, albeit problematic for a lot of other reasons. But pragmatically, it might actually be helpful because there's actually political will behind doing something about trafficking, especially when you conflate trafficking with slavery. So now the big push is to say, oh, trafficking is a term we sometimes use, but it's really about slavery, right? So there's this sort of definitional muddiness that it just keeps getting muddier and muddier and muddier, but the focus is on the back end, the exploitation, and in some ways that's good, right?
This expansion, is it a trend worldwide?
Well, the ILO, I think, buckling to U.S. pressure, has, you know, it used to take a very firm stance that trafficking is only a small subset of all forced labor in the world, and now they flipped it. And so now they're saying, well, actually, we accept that there's a broader definition of trafficking so that maybe it covers all forced labor, right? Which, you know, maybe, so that's interesting for legal scholars, but for pragmatically, that raises all sorts of questions about interventions, right? Because labor approaches have traditionally been very different from trafficking approaches in the sense that, you know, when we think about labor law, we think about creating structure, like worker empowerment, creating, you know, structures to try to, you know, better even out the bargaining position of worker and employer. Trafficking has so it's more of a ground up sort of approach, whereas trafficking has been sort of very much a top down criminal justice. We will jail you. We will fine you. We will come after you. You know, rather than building sort of so in some ways, you know, there's, you know, institutions like the ILO see kind of a threat from the expansion of trafficking. Certainly within the U.S. government, the Labor Department and the State Department have been in this huge war over the definition of trafficking because it has implications for funding, right? How much money is going to go to the Labor Department? Part of the Labor Department, the International Labor Affairs Bureau, covers trafficking, child trafficking. But if the State Department says that trafficking covers, that they own the trafficking portfolio, then and it covers all forced labor, then some of that money might end up getting diverted to the State Department. So there are sort of practical consequences on the ground. Meanwhile, the Labor Department says, look, you know, this goes back to what I was saying before, our approach in terms of our interventions on the ground is to provide technical assistance. We engage in diplomatic efforts. We use tools of, you know, carrots rather than the sticks approach that the trafficking regime has always used. So there's now sort of a lot of angst about, well, what does this mean in terms of how the U.S. government addresses trafficking? Also internationally, there's tension between the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, which has a trafficking mandate, and the ILO, and who's gonna address this problem, right? So there's the institutional problem. Now, in terms of what this means, I want to get to the case study to make this much more concrete.
Yeah.
So I decided to look at exploitation of migrant domestic workers, because within the trafficking field, domestic workers are incredibly vulnerable for a variety of reasons, right? Namely, including that they tend not to be covered by labor law at all, because domestic work is often not seen as work, right? So they're not covered by labor law in most countries. You know, and then when you think about the nature of domestic work, I mean, they're incredibly isolated populations, like in individual homes. And then there's the sense that, you know, because they're working in an individual home, privacy concerns preclude labor scrutiny, right? So labor inspectors don't want to go into a private home to investigate, right? And a lot of these domestic workers can't speak the language, don't, you know, may come from countries where law enforcement is not a good thing. And so there are already structural disincentives against actually reporting, going to authorities when there is a violation. So it's a tremendously vulnerable population, particularly to trafficking. So I wanted to look at...
I guess it's the sense that also they start in the trafficking, being trafficked and then sent to work in individual homes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's the trajectory of a person. They don't start as one thing and only remain... The category or the status of a person changes in the, as they move through the whole trajectory. It's not, you know, the traffic is so they can then be placed in this individual.
Yeah, and so I decided to focus on sort of what I thought would be best practices countries or countries that might offer some, like I didn't want to look at the parade of horribles because there are plenty of countries where terrible things are happening, and so I was interested in looking at countries where there are innovations, where there's the reputation of being good places for migrant domestic workers. So I looked at the Philippines, which is touted it's got such an elaborate scheme for deployment of their migrant domestic worker or their domestic worker. And then I also looked at Indonesia, in part because advocates said that there were some innovations there, and also because OSF has an office there that was interested in this issue. And then on the country of destination side, I looked at Hong Kong, which is held up as, you know, great for domestic workers. They, unlike other countries, have laws dealing specifically with domestic work. And I also looked at Taiwan, which, like Indonesia, had been touted as having some innovations in terms of how they deal with their huge migrant domestic work population as well. So I had gone into this project. I visited Taiwan and Hong Kong and Indonesia. I got into this project thinking, well, when I go to Hong Kong, I'm going to be so happy because
inspired by
what I see there in terms of the labor law being so strong. And what I found was a disaster in the sense that, you know, there's this public perception that Hong Kong is terrific for migrant domestic workers because of this law, but it's completely undermined by the role of labor recruiters. So the standard scenario for Filipino and Indonesian domestic workers is for them to take on huge amounts of debt that for Filipinos requires working for 7 months without pay before you actually earn a penny to pay off that debt. And then for Indonesians, it's more like a year and a half that you have to be working off the debt. Now, all of this is illegal. So in the Philippines, there's a law against recruitment fees, so they shouldn't be paying any sort of fee at all to be placed in this, you know, domestic worker program. In Hong Kong, on the back end, the Hong Kong law prohibits recruitment fees of anything more than 10% of the first month's salary, which is nothing. So it's clearly, I mean, the laws are very clear that recruitment fees are not permitted, yet it's an open secret that they're routinely violated. Open so much that there are tables that show how much of a cut the recruitment agency back home gets, the employment broker on the back end gets. And here's the interesting sort of hidden part of it, which is the amount of money that the banks get, right? So we have these huge financial institutions. I mean, these are the major banks in Hong Kong and Taiwan that are in on this scheme because they get a cut of this fee. And so what happens is the domestic worker is brought to Hong Kong, let's say, and then the employment broker on the back end takes the domestic worker directly to a bank, has the worker who can't read the documents, doesn't understand the documents, sign loan documents that basically, you know, that's the debt she's taking on for the recruitment. And so then the bank pays, you know, let's say 21,000 Hong Kong dollars, which is roughly 3,000 US dollars. The finance company, the bank, pays the recruitment agency directly. The money, so for this loan, right? So she's taking out a loan, but from this bank that gives the money directly to the recruitment agency and never passes through her, right? And so it's essentially a false loan. Like, she's never seen that money. But it's the way, it's how these finance companies get around the recruitment fees, because their argument is, look, you know, we're not involved in, you know, debt bondage or, you know, you know, this exploitative recruitment practice, because we're not in the business of looking into the nature of loans, or, you know, it's a personal loan. We never look at the reason why people take out personal loans, so you can't hold us accountable, right? And so these big banks in Hong Kong and Taiwan and, you know, other major countries of destination, you know, are completely unaccountable under any sort of legal scheme for this, their involvement in this scheme. And so so I was curious as to, you know, so that was one thing that came out that I found in trying to figure out, well, how useful is this law? How useful are these sort of frameworks that are, you know, arguably protective of domestic workers, but there's this huge gap for recruitment, for these recruitment practices. And the advocates on the ground in Hong Kong are, you know, really frustrated because they cannot make any headway in dealing with the recruitment issue. And it's such an open violation. Everybody does it. Everybody knows that the law is being routinely violated. And then the labor tribunals in Hong Kong, so if a worker were to bring a case against the recruitment agency in Hong Kong, I guess there's a relatively new labor administration. Maybe within the last 2 years, there's been a new sort of official. And in that time span, they have never, ever met. There's never, ever been a face-to-face meeting between anyone in the labor department at the policy level and any advocate on the ground, which is incredible. They've never actually had any meetings. And the way that the labor tribunals actually decide on these cases is they typically rule in favor of the recruitment agencies and the employers. They might give a little bit of money to the worker. But what's interesting about that is that they're mediating, they call it conciliation. They're conciliating a dispute between a known violator of the law and a worker, and they rule in favor of the violator, right? And I also, when I was in Hong Kong, I talked to the Philippines labor attaché, who also engages in these sort of conciliation. You know, so if a Filipino worker comes to his office and complains about, you know, having had to pay an illegal recruitment fee, he hauls, you know, the broker and the worker into his office, and then he also conciliates this dispute. Now, in Philippines, under Philippines law, someone who does charge a recruitment fee is criminally liable. They should go to jail, right? And I mentioned that to the labor attaché. I said, you're conciliating between somebody who is probably a criminal actor under your law, your country's law, and the worker. And essentially what he does is they split the baby. So the worker gets some money, and the employer and the recruitment agent gets some money. And so then I asked the labor attaché, well, do you at least send home information, like send it back to your home government, this information about known violators of your law? And he said, no, that's not our job. You know, basically, what the worker he said, you know, what the worker has to do is the worker can file a complaint to our POEA, which is the Philippines Overseas Employment Administration. And then the POEA might take that information and then go after the recruiter back home, but that never actually happens, right? So the onus is on the worker, right? You've got a system where, you know, the labor attaché could be collecting this information about, you know, criminal action, criminal actors, but, you know, that's, they just don't view that as their role, right?
And this company, and these recruitment companies are Filipino companies that have offices also in
Hong Kong.
So
yeah.
It is the role of the home company back in the country of origin.
Yeah. So,
sometimes the claim is that the company, there's also cases in which the company and the receiving side, it's a different company. They're just in arrangements with the company. It's a different recruitment company. It's difficult for a country of origin to hold them accountable.
Yeah, and the Hong Kong government has, I mean, and when you step back from it and you look at this at a macro level, I mean, there's no incentive to police the system, right? I mean, the remittances going home from these workers back to the Philippines are tremendous, like part of the economy. And so they have no, there's not really an incentive to try to deal with this situation. And so what's happening, so what happens now is, so the scenario is the worker signs those documents. She's basically in debt and working off the debt for up to a year and a half. But recruiters now, I mean, I guess there's now a trend where once the worker pays off the debt, has worked off the debt, the employment broker then calls the worker's employer and says, hey, you know, we can give you a discount on the next domestic worker. If you fire the one you have now, we'll give you another one, and we'll reduce your fee. Because it's a limited amount of time. You get three-year contracts, right? And so from the employer's perspective, oh, I get to save. I don't have to pay another placement fee. Like, they're offering incentives to fire that worker so that they can put in another indebted worker, right? And so that's what's happening, is these workers, just as soon as they pay off that debt, they get fired because of pressure from the recruitment agency on the employer. And then what happens is, you know, if you're an Indonesian, you have to use a recruitment agency every time you go. Like, you can't stay on in a country and then take on another country. You have to go through the whole process all over again, pay that fee all over again. And in Hong Kong, if you lose your job as a domestic worker, you have 2 weeks before you're kicked out of the country, right? And so essentially being fired means, you know, deportation. Like, your status is tied to that job. And if you're fired, you've got to go home. So for the Filipino worker, she's out of a job. Now, Filipinos are luckier in the sense that they are allowed to, they don't have to use a recruitment agency for the second tour, so they could try to find a broker in Hong Kong who might charge a little less than a Filipino broker. But if you're Indonesian, you're going home and you're paying that 21,000 Hong Kong dollar fee, maybe to find yourself again in the same situation of having worked for a year and a half and never gotten a single cent. But, you know, the hope is that, you know, you'll get lucky and you'll actually get a job where you actually will make money, because the employer may not fire you, or, you know, like, it's a total crapshoot, right? So that's the situation in Hong Kong, which is, you know, touted to be the best place for migrant domestic workers. It's such a terrible place. And so what's so in terms of innovations, you know, I asked the advocates in Hong Kong what they would do to try to fix the system. And they said, well, we would advocate direct hire. So get rid of the middleman, get rid of the recruitment agencies, and set up a system where the Hong Kong government enters into some sort of bilateral agreement with the country of origin so that they can just hire through a government agency. Basically, the government agency would match worker and employer through some sort of database and get rid of the middleman. So Taiwan has done this. Taiwan has direct hire they have direct hire, but the system is so complicated that the employers actually hire employment brokers to help them navigate the direct hire system. It's so complicated that the workers have, you know, feel like they need to use brokers as well to navigate the direct hire system. And so so that's quite a challenge. And you know, the Taiwanese government likes to say, oh, we're innovative, we have this direct hire system, but it's actually not used very often because it's so complicated. So that's the situation. So in terms of, you know, trafficking versus labor, you know, it made me think, you know, coming out of having looked at this, you know, because I had thought, okay, well, we need to rethink about traffic. We need to reframe trafficking as a labor migration issue. We need to, you know, frame interventions, like trafficking interventions. We need to develop trafficking interventions that try to bolster labor structures, right? Labor law, like encourage the development of more of these worker protective laws in the name of trafficking, right? But which I still believe, but I, but you know, coming out of Hong Kong, I thought, gosh, you know, isn't there a role for how is nobody seeing this as a trafficking problem? Because you talk to any advocate on the ground, they're like, trafficking? What's that? No, how is that relevant? In Indonesia, I talked to the sort of person who was like third highest position in the government over all deployment of all migrant workers abroad. And I posed to him this scenario of a domestic worker who's under debt and ends up in some sort of debt bondage type situation in the back end. And I asked him, you know, wouldn't your trafficking law have anything to do with that? Or don't you see this as a trafficking issue? And he said, no, that's an industrial relations dispute. That's a labor law dispute. It's trafficking doesn't even touch on that. So there's this incredible disconnect in the minds of the policymakers and also the advocates. Even the advocates were like, trafficking? That has to do with sex. What does that have to do with this? And so And so it seems like, you know, if you think about the role that trafficking has had, I mean, the political will that it brings, and the carrots, or the sticks approach, as opposed to the carrots approach, part of me thinks that, you know, maybe there is a more, you know, visible role for trafficking, sort of the sort of strong arm of trafficking to play in these sort of situations when we're dealing with labor recruiters, because the traditional labor frameworks have not been dealing with the recruitment problem. And so maybe that's what I think is a critical intersection between these two paradigms and an area that we should be focusing on in terms of thinking about where does labor and trafficking intersect in a way that could be really helpful when we think about interventions, right? Because it's clearly a gap that neither regime is filling. And people seem fairly skeptical about the labor regime actually dealing with any of that, because labor sanctions tend not to be criminal. They tend not to be very harsh at all, right? It's more sort of building structure. Like the sanctions piece of labor laws tends not to be very strong. And so that's kind of a role that trafficking law interventions might be able to play. Although I say that with some trepidation, because trafficking, you know, it's become, you know, I find that trafficking sucks the air out of a room, you know. Migration people, labor people just don't want to deal with trafficking because all the money's going to them and they get all the attention. So, like, encouraging a broader role for trafficking, I feel a little uneasy about, because I know that that's has its own set of problems. But in terms of pragmatically, I think that there's actually a role that trafficking should play in that sort of situation.
Wow.
So,
was all of that new to all of you? Have you been thinking? Any comments or reactions?
Yeah, I try to, you know, very casually to follow this and this, but these details, especially because when you look at the details, it really becomes apparent that this is a major issue that needs both institutional regulation and probably some publicly provoked pressure to different institutions. But I was wondering, is there some kind of a public, not awareness, but visibility of these issues, both in the sending and the receiving countries? Do people know what is really the mechanics of this situation? And if they do they accept it, as you know, in many places? Well, that's the way things are. If you want to work abroad, that's the way. I mean, some kind of a general complacency, or there are some, as a matter of fact, someone who's revolted or wants to do something about this.
Yeah, I get the sense that the workers aren't quite aware of what they're getting into when they're signing on to these loans. They often, what often happens is there's contract switching. So they might sign a contract in the home country, and then the contract gets switched in the country of destination, so that the terms are different. And often they can't even read the contracts that they're signing, or they're given very little time before their departure. So in Indonesia, for instance, you know, if you're a domestic worker, you typically go, you're sent to a domestic worker training center where you're trained for anywhere up to 6 months in how to do various domestic work tasks. And you're paying for it the entire time. And the women live in these centers. They're not allowed to leave the centers because the recruitment agency has made an investment in them. So they're locked in until they can find an assignment abroad. And so if an assignment comes up, what typically happens is even if there's full disclosure of the loan, the worker is told to sign that contract, you know, hours, like literally an hour or two before she leaves the country to go to the job. And if she doesn't accept it, that debt, like the entire time she's in the recruitment center, she's accumulating debt, right? And so there's the coercion, like there's really no choice but to accept whatever placement comes your way. And actually, you know, in many instances, it's pretty straightforward. Like there's actually a chart that says you will be indebted for 21,000 Hong Kong dollars, and you will, this much goes to the bank, this much goes to this agency, this much goes to this agency, and you will start earning money after 8 months of work, right? She doesn't know that after 8 months of work she'll be fired if the trend is continuing and growing, that she's likely to be fired and finding herself back in the training center hoping that she'll get a better placement. So
yeah.
And everybody, all the government official, everybody knows that this scheme is operating, and nobody, the advocates don't feel like there's anything that can be done about it. And the governments, like I said, they don't have any incentive to really do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, just from our experience in both Indonesia and Nepal, there are several issues at play. I mean, first is... certainly, they do not have enough information. So we, as a program, have been focusing on generating the type of practical information, not so much how to do their job, which is still, it's part of how you avoid some of the violations they experience. But our interest is in make sure that they understand that there are some laws that protect them and how they could access those laws. But the truth is that... When people receive that information, how early in the process is really part of the issue here. So we're trying to reach people much earlier before they actually ideally have made a decision to migrate, before they have signed contracts. But that still translates in practice into a very difficult situation. You have to reach people in the rural areas. And in our visits and speaking with women who have migrated and who are planning to migrate again, you ask them, would you still migrate knowing that there are these many difficulties? And then we're supporting migrants who have returned, and they are organizing, and they're now the voices that are helping others migrate with an open eyes and understanding what the risks are. And very few people, they understand the risk, they don't think it's going to happen to them, and they're still going to migrate. So that's part of what we are finding, is that, yes, our job is to ensure that they have as much information as they are as prepared as possible, but it's not necessarily going to be a deterrent. But second, so that's one level, is awareness and information among the participants, the people directly affected, migrants themselves. The next level is, of course, awareness and among government officials and governments. A very complex picture there, because very often governments are very closely related in various ways with some of those recruitment agencies.
They're investors. Government officials are investors in the recruitment agencies.
And, a lot of the officials at local levels, you know, they're not even full-time public officials. You know, they do have a business on the side. Our experience, again, has proven that at the core of all these problems that we all hear about, that Marian's experience, is indeed the recruitment system. So it's interesting for me to hear you speak as you approaching it from a very different perspective. The conclusion comes down to the same issue of how do we reform the recruitment practices that exist in all these countries and at all levels, reforming at various levels so that we indeed begin to make see a difference in the experience the migrants have, because the role of the recruitment agencies and the practices translate and carry out all the way to when they reach their destination. Those recruitment agencies still have a major role there, and even on their return, it is a very difficult issue to address. But we're trying to identify where there would be openings. And also it translates to national policy, though. So a lot of these issues have to be dealt with at the national level. Our programs, particularly ours, it has a transnational approach. We look at migration as in a corridor approach. So we want to engage actors on both sides. So you really need to engage governments in countries of destination as well, which in our case of looking at the Middle East, this is very difficult. But nonetheless, so then now you have the migrants themselves, then you have government. Now we have also the legal
redress mechanisms or the lack of. So in the meantime, while we try to reform the systems and while we try to ensure that there's lasting policy change, we're hoping that we create additional legal support for migrants so that they have at least the recourse for their violations that they experience. So for me, on the trafficking question is important to try to identify the specific either legal standing that could assist in this case, or what other aspects of the legal of the trafficking experience of the trafficking field do you think we could specifically carry out or migrate to the migration field and the labor migration issue, so that we can indeed maybe use something that has been, I think what you're indicating is that there's a body of trafficking laws that might give us the tools to make some changes in this area. But it's certainly, and I think that for many of your fields, you know, anything that as helps to turn around the situation, particularly when you're thinking of this as the type of control of the worker through these agencies and that exists, is what we're trying to tackle. So we're looking for innovative ideas as well. So,
if the label trafficking and it's complicated legally when. And it's muddy, actually, where regular labor exploitation ends and where trafficking begins. Like, it's really hard to define at one point we call it trafficking. So in the scenario that I gave you, it's probably not enough for the worker to have come under a debt and had to pay off that debt. As long as she's paying off that debt over time, that's not debt bondage. Right? Debt bondage is where she can't pay off the debt because there are unreasonable fees being added all the time, so that the debt keeps going up and it's never coming down, and she works, but the debt keeps stable or keeps going up. And so, you know, when it comes to the trafficking definition, this is the tough part, and why the expansion is interesting, the expansion of the definition is interesting, because, you know, so when we have, I think it probably you couldn't really call it debt bondage until you have a situation where the worker isn't fired. So in effect, she can't pay off the debt because she's fired and has to take on another debt, right? So that, maybe we can argue that's debt bondage. And if you have debt bondage, then you can maybe argue it's trafficking. And if it's trafficking, if you can apply the label of trafficking to a situation, what that means is that a government under international law, assuming they've signed the trafficking protocol, and if they haven't signed the trafficking protocol, then the U.S. government has this whole sanctions regime that's been very influential in terms of forcing governments to actually do something about trafficking. So if you have a trafficking situation, a government is obligated to criminalize it, criminalize all the actors involved, and to protect the victims, so provide them with shelter, legal assistance, psychological counseling, I mean, the whole gamut of protection. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, that's not a hard obligation. They're encouraged to provide protection. You must criminalize, but you should protect the victims under the treaty. But, you know, there's a lot of international pressure now to very much focused on protection of victims, particularly being wielded by the U.S. government. So there's that. And then, but the prevention part of it, I mean, that gets back to what Maria Teresa is saying, and I completely agree. What we found in trafficking, you know, because prevention, so of the three P's, prevention is the weakest P, and all prevention has ever meant in the trafficking field is public awareness campaigns. and so, you know, my project was to say, look, you know, if you really care about prevention, you need to think about labor frameworks, migration frameworks. You need to think about structures, not just public awareness. Because the data that's been developed in the trafficking field shows that these public awareness campaigns, at least part of it is the dynamic within trafficking is, you know, everybody's trying to adopt a trafficking prevention campaign because they want to make the U.S. government happy or they want to get some money from some donor that cares about trafficking. And so there tends to be this one-size-fits-all sort of campaign to public awareness in the trafficking field. So, you know, different countries will take the posters made for another country, totally different context, right? So here's an example. There was, I can't remember which country, but there was a trafficking, you know, the government decided to adopt these trafficking posters that had been made that basically have the back of a woman, a naked woman, with a barcode across her back, right? And that was the big poster that they put up in all the train stations, right? But it was in this remote village where a barcode, nobody knows what a barcode means in this, like, in these remote areas where these posters were going up. But, like, the government was like, yeah, we're doing public awareness. So there's not really, and you know, the studies have also confirmed that the compulsion to migrate is great. Exactly. And people do know, even when they know the risks, they rationalize it as, oh, that's just the destination country. That's just anti-migration sentiment from those rich countries who don't want us, right? Like, that's there's a certain skepticism about that information as well as, you know, even if they, so there's skepticism about the information, and even if they believe the risks, they think that, I mean, the compulsion to migrate is so great that it overcomes that, right? That they have to. I mean, for many of these people, it's not just the prospect of getting a better job. It's for survival. It's not opportunity seeking. It's survival. So they will migrate even when they know the risks. Right? So.
Any other comments or questions? It is a big issue, sir. Yes, sir.
I have a question. Oh, sorry.
Yep.
Regarding the banks, because that seems to be the best way to get some action. Because is it the employee that's paying the debt back directly, or is it the employer that's paying the bank?
Depends. It depends. So in some cases, so I think in Taiwan, if you're an employer and you deduct from the fee, then you could be sanctioned. You know, that's illegal. In Hong Kong, I don't think it is, like, at least not in practice. And so there are two ways. So an employer might deduct from your wages and pay the bank directly, or the worker gets the wage and then goes to the 7-Eleven, because 7-Eleven is like the mediator of all financial transactions in these countries, right? So you go to 7-Eleven, you go to 7-Eleven to pay your bills. So you go to 7-Eleven. So this is what happens in Hong Kong. The worker gets paid from the employer. Then the worker takes that money, goes to the 7-Eleven, and like, you know, engages in a transaction that sends that money directly to the bank, right? And then they get a receipt. So this is the problem with cases that have been brought or attempted to, is these receipts from 7-Eleven are really flimsy and they fade after a week. So there's no paper trail that you ever paid anything, right? And so, I mean, you've seen these receipts. Like, they're like your bank ATM receipts. You know, sometimes they get faded or whatever. They're particularly bad in these 7-Elevens, and they literally fade after a week. So there's no paper trail that you ever paid. And so because the worker doesn't have a copy of the contracts or the loan documents. Like, she doesn't have any of that stuff. And she doesn't even have the receipt from 7-Eleven, so she can't prove a case. Like, it's all hearsay, right? So what they found in Hong Kong is that it's really, really hard to actually prove a case because there's no documents. But there have been a couple of very, very, very low-level cases where I think there was, like, one recent sort of success where where a worker or an organization working on behalf of domestic workers sued the bank saying that this is a false loan and that it violated a money lending ordinance because the money never went from the bank to the worker. So they can't call it a loan, and that violates the law because, you know, loans are structured in a particular way. And so the tribunal, which was a really, really low-level administrative tribunal, found that argument somewhat persuasive, and then that encouraged the finance company to settle with the worker. So, but it wasn't a precedent-setting case, right? It resulted in a settlement, but that was encouraging. That was like the only glint of hope. That was the only thing that people could point to as possibly hopeful. I mean, another strategy that advocates have made is to publicize the fact that these banks are involved in these loans, so that the bank can no longer say, or I'm not sure that how successful it will be, but the strategy is, look, as if we can focus on publicizing that these are what these loans are for and that this is banks are involved in this, then they can't argue that they didn't know, right? They can't. So they're trying to get at that through some public awareness campaigns. No. But legally, that's a hard argument to make.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. It's Christine from the fellowship program. So you had mentioned that you had gone to Hong Kong with the hopes of kind of looking at the best practices, and then you've also mentioned the turf wars that's happening both within the UN and the US government. So what do you now see, I guess, after this research as being the ideal approach towards narrowing the gap between labor laws and trafficking issues? Is it going to be through these large international organizations or governments, or is it precisely going to be through an advocacy perspective of letting both the banks know and both the third highest person in Indonesia, for example, know that actually there are certain areas that do need to be considered as overlapping in terms of definitions?
Yeah, I think all of it. You know, I think it's an exciting moment from an advocacy perspective. In time, because we're seeing, you know, I talked about the divide where the labor advocates don't sit in the same room as the trafficking advocates, but now they're starting to actually coalesce around recruitment issues. So within the United States, for instance, there's a very vibrant group of advocates that's just been developed over the last year to look at recruitment. And trafficking people and labor people are actually sitting at the same table for the first time and trying to figure out what the common language is. And so that's really exciting from an advocacy perspective, because that, you know, innovation can be born of that, right, when you're sort of thinking across disciplines, right? At the sort of governmental level, you know, I'm skeptical about the actual effectiveness of the UN or the ILO, frankly, on the ground. I think at least in the trafficking field, the UN, I mean, there is a treaty, but there's no enforcement mechanism for the treaty. So there's not really a mechanism that the UN can rely on to force governments to do anything. Really what's been effective in trying to get governments around the world to do anything about trafficking has been the U.S. government. Has this scheme that's very controversial, and I've been publicly very critical of it myself, but basically the U.S. government puts out a report known as the Trafficking in Persons Report every year that ranks all the countries according to tiers. Like there are three and a half tiers, basically. So if you're tier one, you're doing great. You know, you're abiding by the U.S. government's minimum standards for combating trafficking. If you're tier three, you're falling short and you may be subject to unilateral sanctions. So the U.S. will cut off funding to you if you fall on tier three. There's a grace period after you're on tier three of like 90 days to improve your performance, but if you don't improve, then the U.S. threatens to take away all your funding. And it's not only U.S. direct money, it's also the U.S.'s vote in international financial institutions. So the U.S. will vote against you getting money from the IMF, from the World Bank, from the Inter-American Development Bank. All the U.S. will use its vote to prevent you from getting any financial assistance. And so that's been actually a really compelling tool in terms of getting governments to actually do something on trafficking. So it hasn't been like the international institutions and the international law that has gotten governments to care about it. It's been the force of the U.S. political, you know, sanctions regime that's really gotten governments to move on this. And so, I mean, and now that the U.S. is taking this expansive view of trafficking, it may wield that regime to deal with situations like the debt bondage. I mean, I've talked to the people in the State Department about this, and they care about this very scenario, and they're trying to figure out, can we call it trafficking so we can go after them? You know, so
interesting.
So that's a possibility too.
Any question?
I guess I wanted to build on Christine's point a little bit, and well, one question had to do with the compulsion to migrate. You mentioned that, you know, the trend has been to oftentimes fire these women. They return to these situations where they have to retake new loans, and these women do that? They're not disillusioned by the system the first time around, and they do it a second time around?
Mm-hmm.
And the compulsion is that great because they're unable to send any money back for that entire year or year and a half that
right.
they worked.
Right.
They survived, but their families weren't supported because of it.
Right. They're going back to the same circumstances that led
right.
them to migrate in the first. Nothing's changed. They still need the money, so they're still clinging to the hope that they'll actually earn it if
the
they just get
around.
Lucky. Yeah.
So I guess my question had more to do with the awareness aspect of it. I mean, there's a lot to come away from this talk and feel a little bit down on sort of the
yeah,
situation
sorry.
Of migrants.
Yeah.
No. This is the reality. And,
yeah.
and you
yeah.
know, this is also illustrative of deeper issues with the way these trafficking is perceived or, you know, conveyed. But when you talk about awareness, prevention needing to be more than awareness, that changes in structures and changes in labor, where do you see the unique value of putting that labor law framework to this trafficking question? I mean, that has been the bulk of your research, and I know you're about to put all of these conclusions together in publications shortly or over the next year. But where do you feel some of these pressure points can lie? Is it coalescing around recruitment solely, or is it much more to do with prompting governments and other officials to think of trafficking as, or to think of this as labor exploitation and therefore trafficking? I mean, so where does that particular, that unique value of trafficking seen through a labor lens lie?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is the political aspect of it, like
mm-hmm.
getting governments to look at recruitment and care about recruitment,
right.
and trafficking will get them there.
And you say they don't have incentive to do that, or do they?
Well, if there's a threat of U.S. sanctions,
okay.
that's an incentive.
Okay.
Although I should say that it's not clear how much of an incentive it is so much anymore. I think it's still a pretty strong incentive because the U.S. actually doesn't sanction many countries. They wield the threat of it, but they don't actually sanction many countries at the end of the day. But what governments care about is where they rank relative to other countries in the report, right? So Indonesia
yeah.
really cares where Malaysia is. And so that's been as much of an incentive is that they want to rank well. For PR purposes. So that's another aspect of it. I mean, in terms of the interventions, you know, I still strongly believe that when we're talking about prevention, we need to
mm-hmm.
bolster, we need to strengthen labor frameworks because, you know, it's unlikely that in terms of the actual interventions. So when I talk about the power of trafficking, I mean the political power of it. In terms of the interventions, right, in terms of concrete rights, you know, we need to have worker empowerment. Like workers,
mm-hmm.
workers need to be able to organize. They need to,
mm-hmm.
you know, there needs to be wage standards. There needs to be the whole gamut
mm-hmm.
of labor protections,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in the domestic. I mean, there's so much to do in the domestic work sector because so many of these laws just don't apply to begin with, right? So for instance, in the U.S., domestic workers are not protected by the National Labor Relations Act, so they don't have the right to organize or to bargain collectively. They're not protected under the Occupational Safety Hazards
mm-hmm.
Act, so they're not protected, workplace standards, safety standards. Functionally, they're not protected by Title VII sexual harassment prohibitions because those laws apply to employers that have, like, many, many more employees. Like, I can't remember the number, like 30 employees. And they're functionally not protected by the Family Medical Leave Act, so they get no sort of job protection in the event that they get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the U.S., we're not, domestic workers aren't protected. You know, live-in domestic workers don't get overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act in the U.S. So part of it, you know, in terms of prevention, that we have so much to do when it comes to domestic work by just applying basic labor law, like recognizing that this is actually work,
mm-hmm.
Is a huge goal that we have to fill. So you know, in terms of prevention, it is you know, strengthening these labor frameworks so that they apply to populations that are in the sort of gray market, and in the sort of informal sector, and then you know, the intersection with trafficking to make very clear that in cases of extreme labor exploitation, there have to be sanctions, like hard sanctions against all those actors, and that they have to be implemented. Because labor law doesn't do that so well. You know, they might afford a penalty, like a financial penalty, which recruitment agencies can easily pay, right? We need criminal sanctions, right? And trafficking, you know, has the sort of power to be able to compel that, I think.
Okay. Thank you. I was going to ask, is the only criminal sanctions, as you say, for instance, if you have decent labor laws, for instance, if the recruitment agency have to register all the guest workers in a country, you know, in order for them to have a residence permit or something to register their contract, a copy of the contract, and to keep the recruitment agency responsible for this. So I mean, really put in place some of mechanism, not, as I said, not only criminal, but administrative law and other places, and then you can keep them responsible not only in fines, but for instance, even they don't comply with these registration mechanisms. You know, the name, duration, copy of the contract, so there is a paper trail or something. Then at the end, in addition to fining them, to imposing fines, you can revoke their contract or their license or something like that.
Yeah,
so that's,
I mean, a lot of countries actually have registration requirements. It's just the recruitment agencies find a way around them.
Absolutely.
So the contract that's on file is not actually the real contract that the worker has signed. Or, you know, I mean, there are so many ways around that scheme. Yeah.
I was just wondering how much you looked into, like, the actual employers, like the families who are employing these people, because presumably they're the ones who are firing them. What does that do just to them?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get a chance. There is an organization in Hong Kong of domestic worker employers, but I wasn't actually able to talk to the head of that. He was out of town. But you know, there are employers who, you know, care about their workers and really care about upholding a certain minimum ethical standard. So what was interesting, when in Hong Kong, I met this one woman, her name is Tanya, who decided, she was actually an advocate who helped a lot of these workers. She worked out of something known as the Christian Action Group and was providing direct services. And after seeing all these cases, she decided to open up her own recruitment agency and abide by the law that they would be charged no more than 10% of the first month's salary. And so her target population is Filipino workers, because they don't have to have another recruiter for the second contract. So she could target, and they're already there. So the cost, you know, the cost of her business wouldn't be so high, because they're already in Hong Kong. She doesn't have to recruit. So her target population are these Filipino workers who are looking for a second contract. And she tries to abide by the 10% limit. But she's the only agency in Hong Kong that's doing that, and she can only do it because she gets free office space and a free phone. Like, she's a one solo show. I went to her office. She literally is operating out of the back room of a store, and the store owner decided to give her the space to help, because the clientele of the store are domestic workers, and so she's running this little recruitment agency. But she was saying that she actually can barely make ends meet. Like, she can't hire staff. She can barely pay herself, because 10% of the first month's salary is too little, actually, to function. So that's the other part of it, is that, you know, it may be that they need to increase the limit for it to be realistically applied.
I was going to ask, I'm Becky from Justice Mission, and I was going to ask, in what way it benefits fitting all of these things into trafficking, as opposed to addressing the issue of how to make recruitment a viable business without violating human rights. So rather than throwing this into trafficking, which could throw the baby out with bathwater, because like you said, the recruiters are sending a lot of remunerations and or remittances and serving that economy that they're coming from, and so I would see how that wouldn't be an incentive to really fix it. But if there could be, I don't know, if from a labor perspective, it would be easier to address the recruiting groups as opposed to a trafficking perspective to stop the recruiting groups.
I'm not sure. So you started off by talking about human rights, like going after the recruiters.
Are you going at it from, I feel like trafficking is going at it from protecting the worker without regard to protecting the recruiter. And a labor approach could provide an incentive to protect a business as opposed to completely shutting down the business.
I wouldn't say trafficking is not trying to shut down the business of recruiting. It's trying to shut down the extreme exploitation that comes out of bad recruitment practices that result from the failure of labor law to prevent them, right? So it's not that trafficking advocates would say, let's shut down all these recruitment agencies. That's definitely not the approach. The reason why I mentioned trafficking was because, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to have political will to do something about it. And, you know, as Maria Teresa said, you know, a lot of these recruitment agencies are owned by high public officials. So they're not about to police themselves, right? And so you kind of need that stick to get a government to actually do something about a problem that they personally have incentives not to deal with. And, you know, labor frameworks just traditionally haven't had much in the way of actual sticks that make people do things. Right? At least really, really bad, corrupt actors do things.
But even just these two interventions, it does remind me of ideas that I have heard floating at times about setting up alternative systems. Yeah, because there is a role, if I were to really be pushed against the wall, is that the role of a recruiting agency can be a beneficial one if it's done right. It simplifies the process, as we found out. It's extremely difficult, complicated, and if you don't have that. And otherwise, they end up, many migrants end up going and in the hands of even less formal recruiters or brokers that said, don't worry, I'll get you to that another country, you're going to make lots of money, and they're not even a company. So that's even more difficult. So we really want to discourage that. So, and as like with everything with migration, it requires some multiple strategies and tackling this issue from every angle possible, that it does remind me about supporting entrepreneurial spirits like the woman you're describing, so the migrants at least have a choice, you know. But anyway, there are at least two. I'm sorry.
It reminded me, I was having a conversation with Jennifer Gordon, who's just down the street at Fordham,
right.
And her new project is looking at alternatives to recruitment agencies based on civil society. Like, so you might have worker-based organizations that are engaging in recruiting themselves. So there are sort of exciting initiatives,
right.
Not really clear. I mean, they're just at the baby, you know, formative stages. But there might be some hope in these alternatives. Also, there are some international institutions, like IOM is now recruiting.
Yes,
like
indeed. I've heard. I've been hearing
it's
this.
Taken on recruiting.
Okay.
It's got a. There's a agreement with IOM, the International Organization for Migration, with Israel to recruit Thai workers.
So
IOM is becoming a recruitment agency, which is I don't know about
there
that.
There might be a role for us.
So
we have at least two other comments.
Yeah, I had two questions. The first one is not really a question, but I was hoping you could expand on the system that Taiwan has. And you mentioned that it was so complicated that it's not useful. And I was wondering if you could just go into a couple specifics about that.
Yeah, I think from what advocates told me, they said that it's a system that requires so much documentation to be filled, like so many documents to be filled out by the employer. That it would require an employer to take a couple days off of work to apply, right? And employers just don't want
to
do that.
To like each individual, or just to start engaging in these kind of.
For each, like if you were to hire a domestic worker through the direct hire system, you would need to take like 2 or 3 days off of work just to fill out the documentation.
Wow.
And to track down all the information, like it
it's
just
so
it takes. Yeah, I don't know exactly what. I'm trying to get more information about exactly.
Yeah.
It's the bureaucracy
of
it. And what's interesting is, you know, I raised this issue with the Philippines labor attaché about why not direct hire? And he said, we used to have direct hire. But we decided, we created, you know, long ago, it was all direct hire, but workers were getting screwed, so we thought, we'll just put in a recruitment agency. The role of the recruitment agency is to protect that worker in the country abroad, because once they're in the destination country, we, the Philippines government, can't do anything. But if they're sort of, if the recruitment agency is there, they're a buffer, you know, they should be there providing services to the worker. Well, clearly that's not what recruitment agencies are doing, but that's the idea, that's the rationale behind requiring recruitment agencies by the Indonesian government and the Philippines. It's supposed to be protective.
Right, they're in the hands of business.
Right. My second question is really small and just kind of a follow-up to what Becky was saying, is that there, I can see how the criminalization or the whacking of the stick for these recruiters would kind of, in a way, only make them, and innovative is not the connotation I want to put on this, but
right.
like more innovative
yeah.
in getting around the stick and these laws.
Yeah.
So I was kind of wondering, do you think there's maybe any kind of beneficial or way to make it more beneficial to like not exploit workers and like maybe some kind of financial
incentives?
Just be like, listen, if you have some kind of proof that the contract that they sign is the same as the one on file, you get like 50 extra bucks.
Yeah, I don't know where. I mean, I guess. I mean, yeah,
and
no.
I'm a small time econ thinker, so that's not like, you know, like you get the.
No. I get. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a good question. You know, that's definitely something I should think about more, in terms of incentives. I guess the question. Yeah, I'm not.
I mean, that's maybe throwing more money at the problem.
I guess my initial reaction is, where's that money coming from?
Right.
But no, it's definitely worth thinking about. You know, positive. Incentives. There are some companies that are trying to develop ethical standards for recruitment, like Manpower is a whole project on ethical recruitment.
Right.
So, I mean, some companies are trying.
But it's exactly that type of mindset that we need, all sectors, all people thinking about something has to be tried.
Yes.
Perhaps it's different because of the traditional way we've been going at this is just not working. Yes,
I can actually withhold my question in the interest of ending on time. Besides, I'm sure I can pick Jamie's brain afterwards. It was a small question.
Anybody can.
Anybody else? Any other comments? Yeah. I mean, we really could go on at this for a long time, but it's just the peak of a wonderful conversation and a very relevant topic, and more to learn, more to explore. So. We'll invite you to come back when you finish.
Okay.
And we'd also, as a program, we might have advanced more on this topic, and we should really continue to be more in contact with you, because clearly, if you pass the labels, get past the labels, we are all really
working on
the same
thing.
Issue. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you
all
for
coming.
Yeah, and thank you, Janie.
Thank
you, Janie,
for
your work.
And thank you.
Thank you.